Welcome. My name is David Bader, and I'm chairing this session. I want to thank Walter Bradley and Ruth Miller for organizing these important sessions on appropriate technology. I'm chairing the session simply because Ted Davis knows me and thought of my name when he was trying to figure out who was going to chair the session. But I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Really enjoyed the first session. And looking forward to these talks. So first, we are hearing from David Unander. David's originally from Chicago and studied agronomy and plant genetics at Southern Illinois University and the University of Minnesota in the U.S. Spent 10 years in research with the University of Puerto Rico at the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. And since then, he's been at the Department of Biology at Eastern University, an evangelical school in Philadelphia. Travels frequently to Latin America and serves on boards at ECHO, Foresta, Hope Seeds, all Christian service missions with agricultural and reforestation works. So, David, thank you for being here. We look forward to your talk.
Okay. Am I on? All right, and I should mention that Floresta, which is a Christian organization involved in reforestation, EM is also on their advisory board, so we periodically cross paths there. Well, I was asked to speak about science and appropriate technology related to agriculture, approaches at work, which casts the net very broadly. So what I've tried to do is put some examples of things that approaches that have worked and then give some cases of those. So if you want a scriptural context for this, in Proverbs it says, plans fail for lack of advice, but with many advisors they succeed. There's good seats up in the front. Those of you coming in late, the witnesses must be a Baptist group. Everybody sits in the front. So anyway, with many advisors they succeed. So we're going to look at several different approaches. Rather than there being a single approach that has worked, there's really several. So one is to consider rediscovery of forgotten techniques, and we'll look at the case of agricultural archaeology and two examples of that out of quite a number that have been chosen. Also, what was conventional agriculture in the not-too-distant past, as well as insights from science, especially a lot of advances that have been made in ecology in the past 50, 60 years, including soil ecology and tropical ecosystems, and then some approaches that have really pulled in ideas from a lot of different places. And two of them to mention are nutrient quality access and something called Farming God's Way that an African farmer is promoting, and then also some examples of new crops. So that's quite a bit right now. All right, here's an example of an insight, possibly, maybe really important for the world, coming from archaeology. Tierra Preta, or Tierra Prieta, in Spanish. It means dark earth in Spanish and Portuguese. How many of you have read 1491? Oh, no. Okay. Again, you and I. Very, very interesting book. Very well written by a guy who's on sort of the infield team of journalists at The Atlantic. Very interesting book. And he has a very good discussion about it in there, so it's become more widely known if you've read that book. There are areas of Brazil in which in the rainforest areas you have these sort of islands of dark earth that's rich in carbon. And for a long time, nobody had a good explanation. There was sort of a geological explanation. This man, among others, is one of the people that began pioneering the idea that there was a cultural explanation. Somebody had actually made these, and that those peoples had vanished with some of the plagues that came through shortly after the first Europeans came in. They had lots of people who were immunologically naive. Throughout a lot of the human tropics, you have red clays, and we won't go into the details of oxisols and ultisols, but red clays are very common throughout the human tropics and subtropics, including, you can see up there in the southeastern United States, all those red clays that they sing about in country music. There's what an oxisol looks like. In fact, you can see it's a red clay. This is a soil profile in Cuyabano, Ecuador. and very little organic matter. You know, the soil profile tends to just be mostly red clay, tends to be acidic, tends to be nutrient poor. For this talk, I dug back into my college textbook in soil science in 1974, and here's what they said. Relatively less is known about the management of oxisols than of any other soil order. The few instances where modern farming techniques have been used met with mixed success. Heavy fertilization, especially with phosphorus-rich materials, is required. So not a lot of optimism about high yields from tropical soils. Here's some pictures taken from a website that the Cornell Research Group maintains, contrasting the Terra Preta with the oxisol. So you can probably see a difference there. This soil seems to maintain its fertility over time. If the explanation of these were made by people groups is correct, then it's maintained a higher level of fertility in the absence of its original creators for about five centuries. You know, so that's pretty interesting as well. This is a recreation of the journey of the first European to ever go down the Amazon River. He went down completely by accident. That's another interesting story. And he reported all the way along, especially the closer he got to the Atlantic, large cities. And those were long considered to be, you know, just sort of a tall tale, storytelling, because people that went in later found scattered tribes. You know, it was not an intensively urbanized area. So the received wisdom from soil science and anthropology in the past few centuries has been that the carrying capacity of the Amazon is very limited. So here's an excerpt from the account in the 1500s. We tarried so long in this land of machiparos, which is 80 leagues in extent, all speaking one language and densely populated with towns and villages, with scarcely more than a crossbow shot between them. Some of the towns extended for 5 leagues without any separation among the houses. All right, some of you don't find that here today. So, could the conquistadores not count? On the other hand, did the soil scientists not analyze oxisols, right? And furthermore, have the anthropologists, like Betty Meggers at the Smithsonian, been incorrect in saying that once you get a village above about 1,000 people, you're going to have a collapse because you've exceeded the carrying capacity? So this, and this, as I understand it, Ian would know much better than I, this is a hot topic of discussion. So it's very interesting. Where people in Brazil have identified these islands of Terra Preta, they're highly preferred for farms. These are photos that I stole from somebody's website, so I can't claim the originality. But there's bags of it being sold in a sort of equivalent of a hardware store in Brazil. And there's heated archaeological debate whether pre-Columbian populations were thousands or millions, but there seems to be a growing consensus that there were stable city centers around which there were these islands of this more fertile soil that they made in some way or another. So some of the components, very high in carbon, all right, 5 to 7 times higher than the surrounding soils, and a deep profile. You know, a high carbon soil going as much as a meter deep, which if you dig in my backyard in Pennsylvania, you know, you might go, I don't know, maybe a third of a meter where you got a high carbon soil. So it's pretty amazing. The carbon is not humus. It's like lampblack. It's, you know, it's a highly pulverized carbon, believed to be derived from incorporation of charcoal. There's some debate about that, but a lot of circumstantial evidence. And it's been quite stable. So the phosphorus is quite high, 200 to 400 milligrams per kilogram. By comparison, some temperate soils, the temperate soils in Oregon that have volcanic ash input are at the low end, they're in that range, and the Iowa prairie soils have phosphorus of 500 to 600 milligrams per kilogram. That's some of the best soils in North America. So remarkably high phosphorus for the humid tropics. High cation exchange capacity, higher pH in an area of normally acid soils, higher base saturation, and all kinds of other things. There seem to be a lot of broken pots. They seem to have incorporated enormous amounts of broken pottery. This guy, who is part of the team at Cornell looking at this, has done some experiments where they followed what changed in the soil chemistry, taking oxisol from Brazil and adding pulverized charcoal. And they found an increased rice yields and that phosphorus and potassium increased substantially. Okay, just adding pulverized carbon to an oxisol increased the availability of phosphorus in the soil. So all of this is still in the early stages. Nonetheless, it stimulated an international conference last year in Philadelphia, in which, like everything else, where we got a new buzzword, it's being called biochar. All right, and this is one potential scale-up model for an industrial scale approach, as well as traditional charcoal making. But one of the ideas is that since the carbon seems to be so stable, this might even be a way to sequester carbon. It might be able to increase the fertility of tropical, human tropical soils, sequester carbon, improve the agriculture in a large part of the world. Entirely novel technology, lost to the world by, Indian cultures no longer exist. Here's another example, raised bed agriculture of Native Americans. There's kind of a continuity throughout the Americas, lots of different parts of the Americas. There seems to have been a practice of growing a diversity of crops in different types of mounds. Sometimes they're referred to as hills, but mounds would be more appropriate. They might be maybe a meter high, maybe a little more, but not, hills. Something like this. This is a picture of a proposal for a restored hill culture in Central America. It's got tilapia, which did not exist in the Americas until recently. But anyway, you have a hill with a variety of things there, and a man with a sporty hat. And if you're in low areas, you have the potential of fish and other kinds of water crops between them. So biologically diverse crops. And the idea here is you're hedging your bets, both with the crop diversity and also with this, sort of corrugated landscape. In a dry year, you plant your, especially if you're in higher, and here you have permanent canals, but if you're in higher areas, because you have this corrugated system, in a dry year, the plants in the lower areas would come through in a really big flood. The ones up on the mountains would probably keep their feet dry. So it's, you get all your family's food that way. It seems like a good idea. Here's some examples. Up in the upper left-hand corner, that's a picture from Waukesha, Wisconsin, after a light snow. This was taken around 1900. It shows where these mounds were still visible. This is an aerial photo from, this is coastal Ecuador. I think they're Guayaquil. This is out in the Chaco. This is an aerial photo from Beni in Bolivia. And this is a painting from the 1600s by a Spaniard of how the Aztecas, this is their system of these beds surrounded by water in this case. So a lot of different areas. Here's some more examples. Here's some functioning chinampas near Mexico City in Xochimilco. This is a repaired system near Lake Titicaca in Puno, Peru, with the canals. Some Peruvian archaeologists, when they reconstructed these, the Spanish didn't understand them, so they just left them kind of soaked up. Recently, in the last couple of decades, they tried reconstructing these, clearing them out, and they have found that plants grown on these survive the nightly freezes better. You create a microhabitat that protects the plants from freezing. Here is the guy who's doing a lot of research in the Chaco in Bolivia. He's reconstructed some, and he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he wants to see what happens there. This is an echo in South Florida. It's known that the Seminole and the Calusa also farmed in mounds, and so this is a local Floridian man who's trying some experiments with trying to recreate that and see what it does in Florida. So, very interesting. So anyway, what comes out of that remains to be seen, but it's another example of a very interesting approach to agriculture. didn't evolve in the floodplains of the Middle East, and there may be some really important insights that come from that. I'm just going to mention this in passing. There's a wealth of accumulated science and experience in pre-20th century techniques. These are some pictures of the Amish in Pennsylvania. Beautiful farms, very high yields. They're never in debt. It's the real advantage of not getting sucked into the agribusiness, big tractor vortex. They're doing quite well for themselves. And some mission groups, particularly the Mennonite Central Committee, have been very effective in a lot of poorer countries, really bringing in insights from things that all of our great-grandparents would have been very familiar with. So all that stuff is still out there. Right? Any good-sized research library has books of how to farm, with a horse and things like that. Insights from ecology and related science. Sustainable agriculture mimics ecology. Should be common sense, but anyway, we had to get it in textbooks, so hopefully we're reading them. One of the insights from ecology in the last three decades or so has been an increased appreciation of how important mutualistic relationships are between plants and soil fungi. I remember when I was an undergraduate, it was talked about a little bit as a novelty, that there are some trees that form these mutualistic relationships. There are some people proposing now that perhaps every perennial has a mycorrhizal mutualistic fungus. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's a fungus that has a propensity, and sometimes the plant requires it, where it wraps its fibers around the outside of the root, sometimes penetrating the outer part of the root, and sends strands way beyond the reach of the plant roots. The plant is leaking a little bit of sugars, the plant is feeding the fungus is pulling in a lot of nutrients beyond the reach of the plant as well as water, and in some cases making antibiotics that protect the plant from plant diseases. So very interesting system. All right. However, the fungi are much more sensitive to stress than the plant roots. So one of the advantages of the soil being cooler and moister is that this type of fungus can prosper. Here's just a couple of examples. Can you guys see this here in the back? It's a little dark, but it's a researcher at the Homestead Experiment Station in Florida. He's got two cultures here of a plant. This is without its mycorrhizal fungus, and that's with it. Here's some leeks in Australia inoculated with a mycorrhizal fungus and without. So in that case, that's an annual getting a burst of growth with mycorrhizal fungus. So that's one of the insights. Simultaneously, there's been a lot of thought about the tropical rainforests. If they really are so hostile, why are the trees so big? The people are often very impressed, they talk about these cathedral type of experiences, and it's true, it's a bold rainforest. Some of the people have been especially important. The Primaveses have done a lot of research on the whole holistic system of the rainforest. So some of their materials available in English, lots available in Spanish and Portuguese. Roland Bunch, who's an American agronomist that spent most of his career in Central America, has done a lot of good synopsis in English of that, and he summarizes it under the term nutrient quality access. So when long ago in a galaxy far, far away, when I was taking soil science, we talked about a banking concept to successful agriculture. You put your fertilizer in, and then that is what you get out. For our exams, we had to calculate, 50 bushels of corn, that's so much phosphorus, and so you need so many pounds of NPK, and so on. So it's very much a checking account kind of a metaphor. The problem is, it's not a very good bank. It leaks. Things leach. Nitrogen compounds volatilize. Things get bound to clay particles. There's a lot of ways that it breaks down. In addition, fertilizers are expensive and they can pollute. Nutrient quality access is the concept that it's not the quantity, but it's whether the plant roots are getting a continuous access at any one point. Doesn't have to be a lot. You know, it's sort of like, it doesn't matter if you have $1 million and you've lost your debit card, you know, and you've got no money in your wallet, you can't buy lunch. You know, at that moment, it's not the theoretical amount of nutrients. It's, are you, do you have something to buy a sandwich right now? That's, make sense? Okay. So nutrient access is favored by maximizing organic matter production. Just not being a course in soil science, you're not going to go into all the reasons for that, but typically cations, electrically charged nutrients, are more available if they're more loosely bound to organic molecules than if they're tightly bound to clay molecules. The more the soil is covered in tropical conditions, the more you're able to have a successful agriculture, just like the rainforest. The soil is normally not exposed to the sun where it's baked. Instead, there's a layer of decaying organic matter. Raindrops don't directly hit the soil, and it's cooler and moister, and all of these mycorrhizal fungi, all these mutualistic fungi are able to prosper. And of course, reduces runoff erosion and increases infiltration. Along with that, the less tillage that there is done under human tropical conditions seems to be advantageous. Favors the whole ecosystem, including soil microbes. Charles Darwin did a paper, he's not as well known for as his little book on evolution, but he did a paper calculating how many tons of soil earthworms turned over during the course of a year in England. And it's a remarkable calculation. You know, like everything he did it very meticulously. It's very interesting. So if the soil invertebrates are in a healthy state, you're actually going to be having turnover of the soil and aeration. A heavy organic mulch can control weeds. Maintaining biological diversity. The rainforests are among the most biologically diverse in the world. Therefore, agriculture in the human tropics needs to mimic that as much as possible rather than monoculture. And feeding plants through the mulch is how rainforest plants feed. So the more the agriculture mimics that, the better. So, two examples of how all these pieces have been pulled together. One is velvet bean or macuna, another plant is green manures, and which came out of Central America, and farming God's way, which came out of East Africa. We'll look at some root crops if we have time here. Roland Bunch, I already mentioned him, he's well known for a book in development circles. He's well known for a book called Two Mirrors of Corn. Has anybody in here read that? Has anybody read that? Very interesting book. It's worth reading. In that book, and when he speaks, if you ever get a chance to hear him, he often stresses that the most important thing that you can bring as an outsider is teaching people how to innovate and experiment. And one of the fruits of that in his own experience was the development of velvet bean. This is a picture I actually took this January in Honduras. This is showing a farmer's field that's been prepared for planting under what has been the traditional method for the last few centuries. It's been cleared with a machete, and then dead material was burned. The farmers would say, people. It was really good and clean. You know, so I'm looking at this, soil erosion. He was promoting contour barriers with grasses at the time. The grasses themselves were a problem. They tended to, the species he was bringing in were kind of invasive, so that was not a good solution. And this particular plant, velvet bean, is not native to the Americas. There were some experiments with it as a cover crop in the U.S. South, and it was kind of rejected. It was rejected by Chiquita. There were some farmers who were experimenting with it. And they developed this system where during the off-season they would plant it. It would completely smother the weeds, and they would go through, cut it up. It's an annual. It's not a perennial like Hudson. And then plant in it. And here's Here's an example of Kevin's was taken this January, the same area where the other picture was taken. This is a farmer on a similar type of slope that uses this system. And here you can see under the velvet bean, it's just this rich black soil. In fact, you probably can't see it in the back, but there's even an earthworm there. And he's been using this system successfully for a long time and promoting it with his fellow farmers. So this has caught on, and there's been applications of this a lot of different places. This is even some experiments in Pennsylvania. Here's corn using this kind of system, although with temperate legumes. Here's corn with conventional fertilizer. Kind of impressive there. Farming God's Way is a system that a white Zimbabwean farmer has developed. He was formerly a tobacco farmer. He had a dramatic conversion in middle age, and he decided to, he's dedicated the rest of his life to trying to improve farming in East Africa. And here's corn in Mozambique, the conventional way. Here's with his system. And some of the principles that he promotes, always acknowledging God first, and he stresses that you need to give. You need to, to receive, you have to sow. And both in generosity to others, you have to commit to whatever you're going to get, you're going to give back, and you need to input into the land. And he refers to the mulch as God's blanket. He also, independently of mulch, and the Prima Vasis, stresses the idea of the tropics of maintaining an organic cover over the land. And he has these little areas he calls planting stations, and that's where you focus. So you kind of like the hills. Here you can see some of that. And there's he has a real scriptural input. He stresses the whole idea of let the poor say, I am rich, realizing what God has given you. That you have the rain, you have the land, you have the mulch. You know, Africa, rather than being poor, is rich and has an enormous potential for producing things in a local way that's not heavily dependent on inputs from outside. So, new crops, I'll just mention this real quick. Sometimes there's old crops that we need to look at more closely. Oats, picked this because we're in Scotland. Very high in protein, more than any other grass crop. For people with type 2 diabetes, a diet high in whole oats seems to, in some cases, eliminate the need for insulin. And in some cases, they've been catching on. Here's somebody selling homemade granola in California. But still, only a minority or a very small percentage of the oats that are grown are used as human food. So sometimes a new crop might be something you think we know. Pass over that. Moringa is an example of one that's been a great success. Small family, it's long been used as a food in Asia, yes, particularly in Southwest Asia. Has some Echo has really promoted Moringa. We don't have time to tell the whole story about that. But now it's widely known. Here's some pictures from Senegal, where Moringa was formerly not native, of whole fields being planted with it for use as a leaf powder. Traditionally, in a variety of ways. I want to jump to the, here we go. Leaves very high in protein, good balance of amino acids, high in vitamins A and C, and essential minerals, and tolerates a wide range of conditions. Stan and Beth Knorr, who are currently with ECHO, formerly with World Vision, in Mauritania. And one of the traditional ways of preparing food there is to have pulverized leaves and add that on top of your dish. So Moringa was not known as a crop. It was a new crop to Mauritania. They introduced Mauritania and promoted using the pulverized leaves with children, especially with malnourished children. Here you can see some of their photos documenting the response. They recently went back to Mauritania. There are Moringa trees all over Mauritania. So I have other examples. They're on the handout. And also among board trustees of ECHO, outstanding Christian organization that does a lot of this kind of work. So Pastor Brochures out of that. So, time for questions? Or?
Okay, let's give it a hand. Thank you so much. much. I can tell you had much more to tell us, and I wish we had more time. We do have time for a couple of questions.
Okay.
Yeah. I was studying Terra Preta in the Amazon in the 1970s, and we did great new carbon dating of the pottery show, and 800 years old belonged to the Guarica culture. And so it is very ancient indeed. One of the interesting thing about it was always associated with latticels, not with oxysols.
Okay.
And so that's an even poorer soil.
Okay.
So it's even more of a miracle that this pre-Columbian technique is so effective. The danger now is that everyone is digging up the areas and deforesting them to exploit it. And so there's a negative side to it too now.
Well, the idea is if we can recreate it, that's, you know, if it's possible to have it as a technology where we have poor soil to incorporate pulverized carbon. And that's ongoing research.
Aren't these just deposits of prehistoric landfills or something like that?
The answer to prehistoric landfills.
That was the earlier theory that people thought. But the areas are too large, I think, to really be just landfills. There must have been more than that, because some of the areas extend for kilometers, and I don't think you just leave your trash like that. So I think they were doing more in enriching the soil, and also the depth of it, which you mentioned, would indicate that they're not.
Well, and the Native Americans also had a landscape agriculture. Everywhere they went, they kind of worked with the whole landscape. I was kayaking through one of the swamps in Florida a while ago, and somebody who was a local was showing me how you can tell where the Palouse used to live, because you get these food plants that otherwise are not native to that area of the swamp, but they intentionally planted them, so you can tell when there was somebody else's garden, there was these mounds. Yeah. The group at Cornell is doing a lot about that. If you go, did you get my handout to find this way down? Okay. It has the names of the researchers, and they have their website, and there's a whole team of people, and it includes microbiologists, and there's other research groups as well.
In addition, there was a huge quantity of acronyms and mice.
Okay.
That was another interesting thing.
Thank you very much.